You're listening to the GP Supervision Australia podcast. Those that know, do. Those that understand, teach. Teaching and learning in general practice. Presented by Dr. Simon Morgan. We would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which this recording was produced and pay our respects to their elders past, present, future, and their families.
Those that know, do. Those that understand, teach. It was Aristotle that said that, so who am I to quibble with an ancient Greek philosopher? And I was trying to kind of interrogate that in my own head and trying to work out whether that really means that a greater level of application of knowledge and understanding of implications allows us, therefore, to teach it. That's what this talk is called today, and we're talking very much about teaching and learning in general practice. By way of introduction, I'm Simon Morgan. I'm a GP here in Newcastle. I'm joining you from a Wobbuckle country, which is here in the Hunter Valley. I am the education manager for GPSA, and I also work in GP training as a medical educator with the RACGP. So tonight's very much looking at planning learning, teaching in the practice setting, and as we are really endeavouring to do now that we have such a comprehensive suite of resources, we'll be pointing you to some of those key resources for which you can use in your teaching and learning. So I guess in many respects, this is one of the kind of most apparent roles. And certainly, I think for new supervisors, one of those more sort of potentially intimidating roles. What? I'm going to have to know things. I'm going to have to teach my registrar. I haven't done this sort of thing before. I'm going to be exposed to my ignorance in a whole range of areas. So very much supervisors hold this teacher role fairly prominently. And of course, it's part of the apprenticeship model where, you know, it's this sort of master apprentice role. Although, interestingly, we are looking kind of at the culture of the supervisor registrar relationship and thinking about, certainly in a teaching and learning capacity, how well suited that master apprentice model is, as opposed to, you know, clinical oversight, where it's very much the supervisor needs and must have clinical oversight of a patient's safety in the registrar's management. But this notion of maybe flattening the hierarchy for a supervisor registrar learning relationship, very much that sort of learning together. Most of the registrar teaching occurs in the practice setting. I'm a medical educator. We run lots of external workshops and sometimes kid ourselves that that's where it all happens. But of course, that's a small fraction. Basically, it happens by seeing patients and learning in the practice. And it happens in two ways, this informal ad hoc corridor teaching or the more formal type of teaching that the colleges mandate that occurred through GP training. Clearly, formal teaching tends to be scheduled where informal is opportunistic. Informal teaching, ad hoc corridor teaching tends to be really brief, obviously, but it could turn into a longer session if people have got time. So formal teaching, as we're going to take a greater emphasis on, is more focused on registrar learning. The ad hoc, quick, brief corridor type encounters often around patient safety and that sort of immediate registrar need. We know that most of that sort of brief encounter teaching is case-based, whereas we would certainly encourage a really broad scope of teaching methods in the formal teaching, and we'll talk about that soon. Touching on informal teaching, I'm not going to elaborate on it in too much, except to say there was some really nice work done a few years ago now by James Brown, who many of you all know is a supervisor, medical educator, GP in rural Victoria, and now works with RACGP. And he talked about the three reasons registrars call for help. And I remember hearing this presented, and it really resonated with me as something that I think supervisors can apply really practically when frequently registrars say, can you come and give me a hand? And that's asking the question, why are they calling for help? Is it they want to be saved? They are floundering, they're drowning, they just need rescue. Is it that they need assistance? They're okay, they're not sort of overwhelmed, but crikey, they haven't seen this before, they could do with some support. Or is it reassurance? I've got this, I think I know, you know, I don't feel hugely confident. Can you come in and just give me a sense of that I'm going okay? And in support of that, I guess, there is this call for help list, one that I would encourage you to use. It was the outcome of some work done by Jared Ingham and team and published in the AJGP. But if you don't know of this resource or you're not using it, please use this at the beginning of term to help support that conversation with a registrar about when they can call for help. And if you as a supervisor are constantly interrogating, why is this registrar calling me? You'll have a sense, I think, of how they're going and get a good assessment of their competency. If a registrar is absolutely drowning, please come and bail me out here. The opportunities for teaching may be less apparent. But if it's much more about reassuring and the registrar isn't floundering as much, there's probably more scope for that teaching moment to occur. We're talking about informal teaching at this point. But let's move on to practice-based teaching in terms of formal teaching. And the two kind of broad areas I want to cover are what to teach, and that's very much about learning needs identification, and how to teach, what methods we can use. How can we really make the teaching and learning in the practice a really rich, robust, interesting aspect of supervision. When I think about what we should be teaching, and we'll get onto the actual individual registrar's learning needs in a second, again, we can think of three broad areas. This is such an important aspect, I think, of our role as supervisors, that registrars are driven by clinical knowledge. And despite the fact that both ACRM and RSCGP exams are very much applied knowledge, interrogation of reasoning, that very broad integration of knowledge, registrars, understandably, you know, they see the exams as being knowledge-based and they want to acquire knowledge. Probably way too reductionist to say this, but we could actually say we don't need to teach registrars any knowledge. They can look all that stuff up and they're actually very good at it. Clearly, we can help point them to resources. We can reinforce some of that stuff. But what our job is and what our strengths are is to teach them the wisdom, the art of general practice, and that is skills and attitudes. In a kind of reflective way, in your role as supervisors, I'd really encourage you when you're thinking about what should I be teaching my registrar, it's not the dose of minocycline for an adolescent with acne, clearly, although, you know, that will come up, but it's really the communication skills with that shy, embarrassed teenager, or the consultation skills to actually invite a conversation with them because they came about something else, or the clinical reasoning skills that may flow from that when there's other issues at hand, or the attitudes around a whole range of aspects of practice. So again, that may sound basic, but I think it's such an important aspect of what we can do as supervisors, moving away from the clinical knowledge and moving much more into the domain of skill and attitudinal-based teaching. And I don't want to get too far into the theory, into the academia, but the Johari window, which is born out of the psychological sphere as a kind of appraisal of what people know about themselves and what other people see in an individual, it's been applied to the teaching and learning domain and around learning needs. The Johari window was devised by two psychologists, one called Joe, one called Hari. And you probably know those areas, open, blind, hidden and unknown areas, but you probably know them much more as these areas of, you know, the known knowns, the unknown knowns, the known unknowns and the unknown unknowns. And you may even know of Donald Rumsfeld, the defense secretary for the US, stumbling his way through this in relation to the war in Iraq. But we're here in Australian general practice, not in US foreign policy, and talking about these areas. And another ME, Ed Polonais, and myself conceived when we talked about this a couple of years ago, the knowns we can see, it's the bit of the iceberg that floats above the surface, but there's all these unknowns that the Titanic could run into. And in fact, we want to run into the unknowns. We want to uncover those. We want to shine a light on those unknowns. And so when we think about this, we're thinking about, well, I've got my registrar. They're going to be driven by two things. They're going to be driven by their wants. We have to support their needs. So they will very much identify their known knowns and they'll learn stuff about what they like. So a registrar that was an ex-physio comes into the practice, they relish the musculoskeletal stuff, and they'll learn more and more about it. And we all do that. That's what CPD is about. We all go off to things that we like, and to reinforce our knowledge and possibly even query the presenter and say, oh, I don't know if you're right there. I hope there's a few of you nodding. Yeah, I know what that means. We also are driven, and registrars want to learn about the known unknown. They're the things that they know they don't know. And that is uncomfortable. I know I don't know this area. Maybe I don't see a whole lot of women's health, so I can kind of ignore it. But I'm seeing a lot of kids, and I know I'm not very good at this. And I have to learn. So they're driven by clinical queries. They're driven by patient encounters. They're driven by things that are interesting. And they've got an exam. So they're aware of the things they don't know. So they're trying to brush up. Most of these things are clinical. So we can help them diagnose this rash. We can help them identify that this is a herald patch, a pityriasis rosea, and a Christmas tree rash distribution, that we can sit and wait, and this will go away in 6 to 8 weeks. We can support them in that, but they can really read a whole lot around that themselves. What we can do, what do they need to learn, is all these other aspects of practice, as I was saying. And they're the areas that I would strongly encourage. As soon as we're talking clinical, we've got time, we've got scope to take the teaching beyond the clinical, let's move to clinical reasoning. Let's think about how the registrar thinks and unpack their reasoning. Let's think about not just the very core clinical elements of data gathering, say what the history taken was like, or their examination, or how they interpreted investigations, but how they synthesize those, how they put them together, how they weight one thing over another, how they seek confirmatory or data that will refute the differential. So that's where our money is. That's what we can really do. So we can talk about consultation skills. We can talk about how to drive this mechanism that basically is our bread and butter. We will see hundreds of thousands of patients in our careers if we have a long and busy general practice career. And we need registrars to come out of GP training knowing how to run and navigate a consultation. We need them to have organisational skills. We need them to be able to manage uncertainty. We certainly have a guide to manage the uncertainty. I've talked about communication skills, patient-centered care, incorporating the patient's agenda and genuinely involving them in patient management. Professionalism, how we can truly embrace professionalism as it exists in this very unique environment of general practice, and how they can be reflective practitioners. So all these things, I guess it's a long and possibly daunting list, but I think when we think about teaching and learning, it's not about reinforcing what they can get from ATG. It's really pushing them to these other areas. That's our absolute strength as supervisors and educators. So you've got this disparate group of registrars coming into the practice. Clearly, they will all have had different exposure in the hospital settings. They've got different needs. How do you identify their learning needs? Let's talk about some that GPSA have put into their learning needs guide. So we talked about past experience, and that's not just past experience. How many hospital terms have you done, and what were they in? And my goodness, you've never seen a women's health patient in your hospital training, managed to avoid them all through your ED time, but also past teaching and learning experience, origin of the registrar, what type of a medical system did they train in and work in, what influences they've had on their learning. If you look at our IMG guide, we elaborate on that, and there's a really, really rich area to think about how registrars have a culture in which they were taught to teach and learn. Self-assessment, there are confidence self-assessment grids, a sort of checklist scenario, which I like, and the call for help list we've talked about. Obviously, all the formative assessment tools that we can use, direct observation, case discussion, et cetera. Certainly at GP Synergy, which has now been closed effectively and now through the RACGP, there is a pre-GP, GPT1 assessment done of registrars' knowledge-based quiz, and that can help identify learning needs. But what I would like to do is to point you to this tool, the 4R framework that GPSA have developed, because it's a really nice tool to kind of think broadly about learning needs for your registrar, and also that focus not just on PCOS as a clinical area as a gap, but more those skills and attitude and those broad learning areas. So when we think of a GP registrar, or think of yourselves as a GP, we interface with four broad domains, and they all happily start with the letter R. So it turns it into the 4R framework. I guess perhaps the first interaction we have is with the patient, and that's a relationship. And obviously, in saying relationship, you're thinking about communication and rapport and connection and longitudinal care and continuity and all those sorts of aspects. So there's that area of practice that the registrar needs to be able to develop and build upon and nurture a relationship with the patient. The second one is they have to interact with the problem. And you might say, well, isn't that the patient? Well, no, because the problems change with every patient encounter or can do. And this is the R for reasoning. So again, we've talked about reasoning, and I'm very, very passionate about the role that we as supervisors and educators play in terms of teaching registrars around reasoning. Again, data gathering, data synthesis, integration, weighting, communication, incorporation of evidence. The third area the registrar interacts with is the system, the wide world, other healthcare providers, Medicare, the PBS, WorkCover, all those aspects of the system out there. And that's this sort of organizational and medico-legal aspects of practice. And the last R is reflection. And that's that the registrars interact with themselves. And so how effective are they as a reflective learner? And so that just gives a schema that's sort of well beyond those very specific learning needs to do with the clinical, much, much more broadly. And you might think, well, that's a nice framework. How do I use that? Well, we can use this self-assessment tool. Please download that. You may reject it out of hand and say, you know, this doesn't help me or help my registrars. But there are two versions of this. There's a self-assessment tool for registrars to complete, and there's one for supervisors to review. And it takes you through those four broad domains and hopefully will help uncover some of those aspects of practice, those broad areas that registrars may not know, they don't know, but are such critical areas of learning need for that individual. And please, can I point you to our Helping Your Registrar Plan Their Learning in General Practice Guide, which is, again, a very practical resource for covering this area. You've got a pluripotential, you've got this stem cell of a registrar, you don't know that they're going to turn into a GP at some point, but you don't know what their past influences have been, their past exposures have been, their learning needs. You have to help them uncover those areas. That's part of our job, and support their learning in those aspects so they come out as a well-rounded GP. Shouldn't their learning needs record follow them through training? Well, I think certainly the RACGP, I think not ACRM, still do not require a formal learning plan. I think that is not the case with ACRM. I think that is required. But one of my really, really big messages to registrars is capturing the learning needs. I don't care how, sticky notes, exercise book, notes on their phone, some way of saying, I saw that patient and I need to learn more about it. And again, not just because they didn't know how to manage their psoriasis, but because they stumbled around and thought their communication skills may have been better, or that you observed them and their consultation structure was sketchy. So I don't really mind. And in fact, there's some evidence around learning logs, learning plans, written documents not being that useful, and in fact, sometimes being a barrier. But I mean, no, I do not push learning plans with registrars, but I absolutely push as hard as I can capturing learning needs in order to be able to review them. But let's move on to the how-tos. We've done some of the what's. I know that's a very quick overview, and I guess what I'd be saying is please have a look at the guide. It'll cover what I've talked about in a whole lot more depth, and have a play with the 4R resource and see what you think. So what teaching methods can we use in practice-based teaching? So patient record audits, case review, case discussion, the role play cards are excellent, direct observation and vice versa. There was a paper written many years ago now in the AFP around how to have a learner, in this case a registrar, sit in. It's not just sit in a corner and look, but unpacking what we do. That's such a powerful teaching tool. So I did a teaching visit today and I was thrilled to see the registrar book a patient who had a big keratoacanthoma on their hand that he wasn't brave enough to do, in with the GP who does all those in the practice, and book himself in as well to see. Extending topics beyond immediate patient case. So that might be around using some hypotheticals and what ifs, lots of direct observations, which is good. Sitting in with me, using checks, GPSA teaching guides. You're probably heart sinking and thinking, oh my goodness, is Simon not attempting to talk about all of these things? What I will do is say, no, I'm not. But I want to just sort of look at them a little bit sort of categorically and also point you to the practice-based teaching guide that GPSA have developed, which covers all these in some depth. And I like to talk about case discussion as part of teaching to cover all these areas. And you might think, really, that's a broad kind of approach. But really, when we think of case discussion, it is just discussing a particular patient encounter or patient, you know, multiple encounters. And there are just various entry points. So the entry point might be, I sat in with you and watched this and let's talk about it, direct observation. Or you brought this patient to me at the end of the day because you're not sure what to do. That's problem case discussion. Or I've randomly chosen a patient, random case analysis. Or I'm going to look at an inbox and find a pathology result. And that's my entry into the case. Or let's have a look at some recent prescriptions you've made. And that's my way of looking at the case. So all these, I guess, are case discussion. And there are ways to do case discussion. I'm going to talk about one, PQRST. You might think, oh, I don't know, that doesn't sit with me so well. But I like to think all those things are case discussion. There's also a bunch of demonstrations. That's where we as supervisors can potentially demonstrate best practice, or at least our practice, in how things are to be done. So reverse direct observation. Physical examination teaching, I don't think this occurs enough in GP training. This, and clearly, you know, there are significant limitations about what's possible, but some of the MSK things, walking your way through some of the examinations, like a skin check, without obviously one or either having to expose themselves. You know, I think we can actually build physical examination teaching more into what we do in practice teaching. Procedural skills, clearly. Role play, I'll come back to that in a sec. Topic tutorials. So, very much the vast majority of how we teach is driven by patient encounters, what comes through the door. But what we should endeavor to sort of plug gaps and cover areas that it's quite conceivable a registrar in training in your practice won't see a patient with a TIA in the time they're there. They're not common. But when they occur, you don't want the registrar not to know what to do. So that's where topic tutorials on either less common but, you know, serious or really important topics, or, you know, really common topics, diabetes or arthritis or hypertension, we can use topic tutorials using something like the GPSA guides. Registrar doing teaching, role modelling, I guess you could see as part of the supervisor's role, and mentoring a bit more actively so, nursing home visits and exam question reviews. But I will really, really passionately flag with you the benefit of role play. And I know many of you will be thinking, but I hate that. And the registrar particularly hates that. It's really exposing. What I would say is, yes, some of that's true. Both colleges will require registrars to role play in terms of their assessment, so they need to be able to do it. But the point for me is that role play doesn't need to be, let's do a 10-minute role play. It can be a 30-second, a 15-second role play. What form of words would you use with me if I was the patient? Just say it to me now. For that short period, that's role playing. And so really, as a demonstration, yes, I might, you know, you be the patient, I'm the supervisor. I will tell you how I like to explain a patient who has impaired fasting glucose on the basis of their blood results. This is the way I do it. That's role play demonstration. But role play can be part of every single one. And in fact, I would encourage you to not do a teaching session, not do RCA or inbox review or review of an audit or anything without doing a little bit of role play, without saying, I haven't done my role play. What aspect of this can I just get the registrar to do with me or me with them that might take 30 seconds? just to continue to build that sort of practice, that demonstration. But I do see it as something that we is such a powerful teaching method, and it's something we can and should do more of. Random case analysis, the three W's, the what, the why. Although interestingly, I ran a session on random case analysis a couple of years ago, and one of the supervisors said to me, you know, I don't like the question why. It sounds far too interrogative and potentially critical. I prefer how come. So not why did you prescribe that particular medication, but how come, perhaps a little less potentially prejudicial. And of course, the hypotheticals, the what if questions. And so just for a bit of fun, the man, 51, diarrhea for 7 days, given some Lomotil a couple of days ago, watery, no blood, he's been camping, his belly's nice and soft. He was treated with some Flagyl and sent a stool away. Where would you take it? What types of questions? And of course, I'm imagining most of us would say things like, why Flagyl? What do you think the differential is in terms of elaborate on what it might be? What more provocative questions might we ask? One of my other absolute passions is rational testing. We can and we should absolutely critique our registrar's pathology ordering. And, you know, that was a really key area. The reasoning behind testing, and I think hopefully we're starting to think, yeah, so testing more history, other exam vital signs. And the registrar obviously will want us to hover and focus around all these clinical areas. They want us to identify their clinical gaps, and we can explore that, and we should explore that. This is a really nice, rich case. But in terms of the whole RCA model, we need to think about other domains of practice. And you might think, well, how does communication get a gig in looking at a set of notes 2 days after the interaction? Well, it might be, what was the communication like with this patient? What do you think the patient's agenda was? Were they worried about something? Do you think you reached common ground in terms of it? And clearly, that might be a much more appropriate set of questions to ask in, you know, a sexual health history or some other context. Public health issues, what are our public health obligations in a particular, you know, driving and safe, not talking about diarrhea here, but, you know, those sorts of things. Medical legal, are there medical legal areas and adequacy of documentation, which wasn't highlighted. So safety netting, I think such an important element. So that's sort of thinking about more broadly, patient safety, consultation skills, those sorts of things. What if it was an 80-year-old? And absolutely. What if the patient was 80? What if the patient was 6 months old? Changing the domain and introducing some of those hypotheticals. If you're not thinking broadly around the non-clinical elements, and I'm not saying to do this at the expense of the clinical things, but clearly, you know, there might be some really important areas that warrant pursuit or posing some what is, particularly for the more high-functioning registrars, a plug to do that as part of your RCA. We're just going to talk briefly about PQRST in terms of GP training and supervision and case discussion. As with all these models, this 4R thing that I talked about before, or the RCA approach, or PQRST, this is absolutely not to say, here's the model, you must use it. It's about saying, what do you think? Do you think this is something that you can incorporate? There might be elements you'll pick out. It might just tweak the way that you undertake a certain element of supervision, and in this case, case discussion. But PQRST, again, really happily, like 4Rs fell out very nicely, is a series of 5 steps in terms of case discussion with a registrar. And it can be used either in ad hoc corridor type teaching or more leisurely, structured, formal teaching when we're talking about cases. And what does it stand for? P is the patient's problem, and I'll talk my way through these. Q, what's the registrar's question? R, how well does the registrar reason? S, what's the solution? And T, what can be taught? And so again, if you like kind of trying to apply a mental framework when you're doing this thing, great. If you just think, yep, some of that was kind of useful and I'll apply when I do my own version of case discussion or allow it to be pretty organic, all good. But in terms of just unpacking this briefly, there is a thing that's been written up in the clinical reasoning literature called problem representation. And it is really very much a way of presenting cases. So the first thing is, what is the patient's problem? And of course, the registrar will say, I've got this 80-year-old guy and he's had headaches. And you will say, do you remember that thing called problem representation? Let's talk about that. And essentially covers some key areas of the problem. And it's really two or three sentences. It's not some elaborate kind of medical student synthesis of the history, but it is very much the key features. So the key areas on history examination, including positives and negatives of the patient's demographics and risk factors, the temporal pattern of the illness, including getting worse, getting better, waxing and waning, those sorts of things, and the clinical syndrome. And you might think, well, sure, that's pretty basic, but my observation of so many registrars when they present cases is that they're really pretty poorly formed. And I think we can say to registrars, you know what? What I'd like you to do is to have a bit of a think and form this into a problem representation, and please present the problem to me again in a problem representation. And they may find that a bit awkward, but I think if they do that, well, in fact, there's evidence that if they do that, they will develop their reasoning skills. The second thing is, what is the registrar's question? Now this, and I've talked about the three areas as to why they're asking it, and this may sound incredibly basic, but it, you know, sometimes that is not clear. And it's actually really important for us to say, you've presented this case, you said you need some help with it, but what exactly do you want to know? Is it who's the best neurologist to refer them to? Is it, should I do an MRI? Is it, what's the differential? Is it something quite different? If it's not apparent and clear, ask that very question. What exactly are you asking of me? And again, it's really useful for the registrar to stop and go, well, actually, that's a good point. You know, what do I want to know from you? Because it can't be everything. It's got to be a specific question. I've talked about reasoning, but clearly, as we're talking to the registrar, as we're getting the problem representation, as we're probing for further information, as we're understanding what their question is, we are getting a sense of all these things, how well they can come up with a differential, manage uncertainty, include the patient, all that stuff. And we're building up this picture of how well they reason. They have come to us either in the corridor or at the end of the day because they want some help. They need some teaching, and we are obliged to give them the solution. And I mean, maybe that's a step that doesn't even need to be put in there, but clearly it's such an important one, it should be. You know, they may say, I don't know what to do. This ask before tell, absolutely, whatever we do, we don't and shouldn't tell the registrar, this is what I think. Always say, what do you think first? And get them to think first. I mean, that's so basic. And yet I did a teaching visit a couple of weeks ago and saw a very capable supervisor come in and say, I think it's this, as opposed to saying, what do you think the differential is? And lastly, what can be taught? And again, it's your wisdom, your experience, the art of general practice. Yes, the clinical stuff's important, but the breadth around that. Identifying learning needs, learning the language of supervision and reasoning, focusing on skill development rather than knowledge acquisition, I should put in there, and attitudes, focusing on the consultation and how to help a registrar navigate the thing, utilising the whole supervision team with Ask Where to Foretell, which I've just covered, and we've talked about a whole variety of teaching methods. A couple of guides, the planning learning one covering identification of learning needs, and the practice-based teaching one covering the what to teach and the how to teach. And I guess the overarching guide that I referred to right at the beginning, which is the new supervisor guide. Many of you are using the teaching plans. We have now, I think, about 100 of these, various types, some on consultation skills and some on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health, and a whole bunch on clinical aspects of care. So continue to use those that are. Even if you don't, just tell your registrars that they're good study resources. And of course, can I point you, as I'm going to try to do as a routine, to your individual college supervisor guides for ACT and RSCGP. Thanks all. Always wonderful to have the opportunity to talk to supervisors from around the country, upskill you in some aspects of supervision and general practice training. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. We'd love your feedback. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please give us a rating and or a review. And if you haven't already, please subscribe and share this podcast with your colleagues. If you'd like to ask a question or suggest a topic, you can reach out to us via our social channels. simply search GP Supervision Australia on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram or Twitter. GP Supervision Australia is supported by funding from the Australian Government under the Australian General Practice Training Program.